Well, good morning to everyone. Happy New Year. Happy New Year. We made it. Not all of us were convinced. And yet here we are, 2021. It is wonderful to see so many faces this morning. And I think it's rather appropriate that it's a really bright, brilliantly luminous morning here in the Twin Cities, here in Minnesota. Really, really bright today. So like all religions, in the darkest part of the season, Buddhism celebrates the coming of the light. And so this past month, we celebrated Buddha's Enlightenment Day. We do that in the Zen tradition as part of the annual Rohatsu Sesshin, the long 7-day intensive meditation retreat that we do. We celebrate the coming of the light in the form of Buddha's enlightenment. And now as we're moving together all into the year 2021, I want to talk about reality and hope. So that's my title today, reality and hope. I was asked by some of my friends at Augsburg University here in the cities to offer some short reflections for their group, their mindfulness chapel group on hope. Because it's, you know, going into the new year. And I thought that's obviously appropriate seasonally and probably appropriate given the things that we learned about ourselves collectively in 2020. The offering of hope is something that I think has been much on the mind of spiritual aspirants all over the world. So I'll offer what I have today, but I would encourage you to look within yourself for your own dharma, for your own expression of what this might be for you. Reality and hope are things that we orbit all the time in our tradition of Buddhism, but they're certainly something that we're in relationship with all the time, right? Whether we consider that part of our official practice or not. So I encourage you to do some exploration into these things, you know. So in our religion story, in the central kind of enlightenment myth, the Buddha's life story of the Buddha's life story, while he was still just a normal person in the darkest of times, the darkest part of the year, this person who would become the Buddha sat down under a tree and underwent an assailing. He underwent three temptations that were designed to prevent his awakening and his bringing the light of the Dharma to the world. That's one of our central stories. He was assailed in the story by raging desire, by paralyzing fear, by crushing self-doubt and shame. And in the myth, his battle is portrayed as having cosmic significance. The battle that waged around him was portrayed as having cosmic significance. The temptations and the potential of awakening were all seen as having cosmic significance. So invisibly all around him, there are described armies of angels and demons, gods and devils, all aware that a great turning, a great change is possible, and the potentiality of great hope is present. So some of those cosmic forces are portrayed as wanting to midwife the birth of the light, and some of those forces are portrayed as wanting to prevent it. But all of his demons, all of the demons, came to visit. And the one who would be Buddha was assailed. Of course, in Zen, especially in contemporary Zen, we regard this story as being about all of us. It's not about exclusively about someone who lived and died 2,500 years ago. It's about you. And your path is also one of cosmic significance, because Buddha and you are not two. So at this turning of the years, this turning of the seasons, when we reflect back, we can ask ourselves, did 2020 feel at all assailing? Did we feel assailed by armies of demons? were we supported in any way or inspired by armies of angels? It is probably reasonable to say that the past year was different than any other for all of us. As a community of Buddhist practitioners, we find ourselves challenged along with everyone else in the world. The very real world burdens were placed on all of our time, on our money, the needs of so many in our lives who are affected by the global pandemic and massive social upheaval that have resulted for many of us in our day-to-day lives as experiences of exhaustion, overwhelm, illness, terrific stress. Many of us this morning are grieving the loss of loved ones. Some of us are fearing for our own safety and even doubting many of the systems that are designed to care for us. Some of us are wondering how to pay the rent, how to pay the mortgage, how to support our sick neighbors, how to support our relatives. We're wondering how to protect an obviously dying planet that's continually under threat, how to best educate our children, how to plan for the future, and for what future? We've seen a lot of very real darkness in 2020. And many of us, of course, right now are really beginning, as we have for months, to yearn for human contact beyond these screens, right? And still others of us wish we could escape the humans around us. They create in us feelings of unsafety. And a lot of us are bracing for more of the same for the foreseeable future. Perhaps even larger systems collapse that may still be coming. So in short, if you are feeling assailed, if you are feeling besieged, you are not alone. This is dukkha, the human condition. As Katagiri Roshi, our founder, said, human consciousness itself is already suffering. At this point in my relationship with Zen practice, it's been a few decades now, I can say that I know at least two things with certainty about this tradition. One, Buddhism is intensely and relentlessly realistic. And the second is that Buddhism is intensely and relentlessly optimistic. The first two noble truths of Buddhism express the reality of suffering and how it's created, right? The second two noble truths express the reality of hope and how it's created. Those teachings, those four noble truths, in my mind at least, are still a revolution. After 2,500 years, the core idea of Buddhism, that we can change reality for the better by evolving our own personal consciousness, is still a revolutionary one. So, before I go any further this morning, I want you to hear me say that I honor you and I honor your practice. I thank you for commitment, whatever kind of commitment that you have. I thank you for that commitment to the Zen path. I thank you for your commitment to attempt to bring compassion to those who are suffering and for your own vow to actualize Buddha in this very life. I can see how the strength of our shared practice can assist us in acting in this world with more clarity and more kindness. Because we can learn to become less attached to outcomes. We can respond to a world that is hurting with less clinging, with more appropriate action. We can invite ourselves to simply trust what is and to be present to it. And when we do that, we find the direction and the clarity that we and others so dearly need. And ultimately, it seems to me we don't need anything more than that. Just enough clarity to offer us a sense of direction, right? As the landscape is always changing, in Zen, a compass beats a map, right? The landscape is changing all the time. Reality is impermanent. So for us, a compass beats a map. As Buddhists, we are taught about impermanence, and we understand impermanence and the inevitability of change. And we understand the suffering that our response to change can create. The first and second noble truths explain that within the soil of inevitable change lie the seeds of suffering, anxiety, uncertainty, insecurity. But the soil of change also contains the seeds of hope. And hope is a word that oftentimes gets a bad rap in Buddhism. Some of you know this, because the word hope is often used in relationship to the future, and because it can very easily become a form of attachment or grasping disguised as hope. Greed can disguise itself as hope pretty easily. And so if our hope has a very specific vision or form or narrative, it's probably not actually hope. That's how the personal agenda kind of sneaks in for us, right? Actual hope, at least the way I'm talking about it this morning, is not a story of the future. It is a state of the heart, a state of the heart-mind. It is not a blind belief that things will go in a certain way, or even that things will go well, by my estimation. Instead, it is, as Vaclav Havel said, a deep orientation of the human soul that can be held at the darkest of times. Deep orientation. Isn't that a beautiful turn of phrase? That feels like the compass. The needle of the heart pointing in a direction. Hope is a state of consciousness based in the truth of our direct experience of lived reality. It needn't be manufactured. It is based on the truth of our direct experience of lived reality. Hope is the third noble truth. And how to embody hope is the fourth. It can therefore propel us from that deep orientation to active engagement in the world. The emotion that we call hope sometimes is lovely, really lovely when it shows, but it's optional. That's not what we're talking about. Our bodhisattva vows express the intention to be hope, right? Not to feel a certain way, but to actually be hope. To make space for the chance of a different future, right? Our bodhisattva vows also express our non-separateness. So the chance of a different future is personal, but it's also collective. In Buddhism, the truth of our non-separateness is understood to be a relative. Truth, true, but relative. It's one to be understood as fully true, but as only kind of one half of an equal and complementary truth, which is the truth of our non-separateness, right? The truth of our separateness and the truth of our non-separateness are both held, right? Form and emptiness. But it's important that we understand separateness to be exactly that, separate. Non-identicalness. I don't think that's a word. Non-identification. Separateness is relationship that includes space. We mustn't allow the experience of separateness to devolve into division. That's a very different thing. You can kind of feel it, can't you? When I say those words, separate and divided feel different because they imply different states of relationship. Separate simply includes space. Divided suggests adversarial conflict. Separateness is inevitable. It's related to truth. Sometimes apartness, right? But divided is optional, and it's related to a delusion of some kind that would create conflict. So for Zen practitioners, this means we can't devolve into division within ourselves. Divisions and symptoms and symptoms of conflict and systems of oppression in the world, in the external world, can only be made manifest from divisions and symptoms of oppression that exist within each of us and within our collective human heart mind. Right? That's why the starting point for our work is here. So as a Zen student, to be really responsible, I have to ask myself, what voices in me do I refuse to hear? What populations in myself do I marginalize? What personages in myself do I ignore? What truths about myself do I imagine are so shameful that they mustn't be even acknowledged by the light of my own awareness? How do I create splits in my own heart mind? That's a responsible question for a Buddhist and a Zen practitioner to ask. This is why we have a thing called Zazen, to give us a safe refuge in a container to begin to ask questions like that. Recognizing the division and the splits within ourselves is the first step toward healing them. So I'm no longer compelled to create systems of oppression in the world and divisions in the world. And I recognize what is separate and I recognize what is divided. I have then a chance of bringing a whole heart to relate to those things, right? So with practice, with time spent in Zazen, time spent studying sutras, time spent in community, with fellow practitioners, like we're doing this morning, time spent talking to teachers, my Zen practice can begin to grow so far that it can show me that Indra's net is internal. Every part of me is connected to every other part of me. I'm all of it. All the facets, right? All the darkness, all the light, all the humanity, all the divinity. All the angels, all the demon. I'm the assailed and the assailer, right? That's a map of the internal reality of a human heart, IndraNet. So is it possible with patience, with thoroughness, that my inner awareness can develop to the point where I can illuminate every corner of myself with curiosity and the willingness to connect? Is it possible? I can be so thoroughgoing, after years and years of sitting over and over, moment after moment, breath after breath, right? The refining that we do every day when we do our Zazen. Is it possible to do that, to become so thoroughgoing, every single little part of that human heart is willing to show itself, is willing to rush forward to be seen? Is it possible to become so like Buddha in my Zazen that my gaze is completely gentle, completely kind, and every shadowed, wounded part of my heart rushes to be met by the light? That is the story of Buddhism. That is the promise of Buddhism. The answer to that question isn't rhetorical. Is it possible? You've heard the story, you know the answer. Imagine not being frightened by any feeling. Imagine knowing that nothing will destroy you, that you are beyond any feeling, beyond any state. Imagine a Zazen that clear, that kind, that powerful. Imagine a life lived that clear, that kind, that powerful. These are core teachings of Buddhism. You needn't be frightened by any feeling. Nothing can actually destroy what you really are. You're beyond any feeling and any state. Right? You're sovereign. That's the story of the three temptations. We can imagine what a life would look like if every cell of that person's body believed this, actually actualized it. It's written into our DNA. If we actually could wake up to that, what would that life be like? Can you imagine the service one could be of, the service one could do, the compassion one could offer, the wisdom one could embody? Well, what can I do would just naturally become, how can I be? And this kind of mind, this Zazen mind, won't let your family be limited to only your relatives. You can find a new place to be from. So we must be intentional with our practice. We hear our teachers tell us this all the time. Be thoroughgoing. Be intentional. Be mindful. We must offer to ourselves a model on how to be in this coming year, because we know how to be, right? That's the power that we so intentionally, we so scrupulously cultivate in our Zazen, right? We understand suffering is. We understand that suffering exists, that it's real. And we also understood that we have our practice. We have a response. We have our open hearts. Then it's easier to actualize the vow of the Bodhisattva. However inexhaustible the states of suffering are, I vow to touch them with patience and love. Isn't that nice? That's the Thich Nhat Hanh translation. Same vow we recite, but he's got a little different word choice there. However inexhaustible the states of suffering are, I vow to touch them all with patience and love. So circling back, returning to that story of Buddha's temptations, Buddha's enlightenment, can you see the third temptation there, kind of woven into that first Bodhisattva vow, that vow that we'll all chant at the end here? The temptations, first, right, unswayed by the desire to leave suffering for empty pleasure. Next, unmoved by the fear of suffering and the voice that promises death, Buddha's third and final temptation, and his final choice is to stay. The temptation is to leave. Of course, who does he think he is to be sitting under that tree? Who does he think he is to even imagine hope? To even imagine awakening in the face of such suffering. His choice is to stay by simply touching the ground. He vows to stay right here in relationship with all of the earth, all of the human experience, all of the suffering that it entails. Our vow is, I vow to touch all the states of suffering with patience and with love. The hidden temptation in this story about being assailed and assailed and assailed, and the hidden temptation that's woven right into the first noble truths, especially when we first read them, can you remember kind of how you felt? Maybe when you first read about Buddhism and you first read about the Four Noble Truths, there is a temptation that I think is omnipresent for us, and I think it's really been seen and felt collectively this past year. It's nothing new, but we have really, really, really felt, I think, the temptation to fall into despair. Despair is a huge spiritual trap. It is a huge temptation for all of us, right? Along with grief and anger, despair was certainly one of the most prevalent collective emotions of the year 2020, right? Despair is a huge temptation on the spiritual path, regardless of its form, right? It claims lots of people's practice. It is a huge temptation in the human world as well, and it claims lots of people's hearts. I think we know this. I think we have felt, all of us, what it feels like to have despair claim our heart for a minute, for an hour, for a day, for a decade. Surely you recognize in yourself what that is. Surely you have people in your life who you realize, oh, they've been taken by despair. And the first noble truth for a lot of folks is enough. The inevitability of suffering. The inevitability of suffering. The inevitability of suffering is enough to kind of, if existence itself, if Katagiri Roshi is correct and human consciousness is in itself suffering, the fire sermon, right? If existence is fraught with inescapable suffering, what's the point? Right? Who do you think you are to attempt awakening? It kind of makes sense, the story of the temptations. It flows very logically. So who do we think we are to be Zen practitioners? Who do we think we are to sit Zazen this morning? Who do we think we are to transform society, to try to create loving community? Who do we think we are to overcome centuries of patriarchy, racism, violent attempts to control our natural world, hundreds of years of violence, genocide, alienation, economic destruction, militarism, consumerism, industrial ecocide? I could keep going. You know the list as well as I do. Who do we think we are to try to stop that? It's easy to despair because it feels and it looks like an honest acknowledgement of the truth of suffering. Acknowledging suffering and despair can actually feel like the opposite of spiritual bypass. It can seem like it's more in tune with reality. It can seem like it's more connected with things as they actually are. Despair can actually feel like the antidote to some sort of fanciful escapism, right? But despair is a near enemy of honesty. Despair is a near enemy of truth. Because as real and as true as the emotion of despair is for us, the heaviness, the sadness, the grief, the despondency, right? As real as that emotion is, the storyline of despair, the narrative, that's where we see it. That's where our wisdom comes in. That's what we get to recognize as unreal and untrue. The emotion of despair is a direct felt truth of enormous suffering and our connection to it. And we can develop, and we do in our practice, right, the capacity to meet that emotion with increasing capacity for compassion. But if we pay close attention, our wisdom can also see that the thoughts and the storylines that attend that emotion are falsehoods. They're falsehoods. The Buddha taught every morning we are born again. What we do today is what matters most. Just as a snake sheds its skin, we must shed our past over and over again. One moment can change a day. One day can change a life. One life can change the world. This is starting to feel like the third and fourth noble truth. Like Buddha, we have every right to awaken. And just like Buddha, we can touch the whole earth with even one tender human fingertip, your fingertip. So please don't think that my intention this morning is to be simplistic or cute. Please don't equate optimism and hope for cloying, saccharine shallowness. We have a tendency to do that. If it feels good or feels positive or optimistic, we tend to discount it as shallow or childish. We also tend to do the opposite. We tend to mistake cynicism for depth. don't we? The more jaded and cynical we are, the deeper we are. Do you sort of see the falsehood there? Buddhism actually teaches us, not in these words, this is my paraphrase, but my paraphrase is cynicism is actually just spiritual laziness. Cynicism is just spiritual laziness. Storylines of despair and hopelessness and cynicism are temptations we all recognize and we all face every single day. We see them in ourselves and we hear them from the world. And we become increasingly able to recognize them for what they are. They're boring. They're stupid. They're one-note drudgeries. Listen to this. Listen to the narrative. You'll hear it. Give up. Give up. Give up. Give up. That's boring. It's literally boring. I'm using that word with intention, right? Give up. Give up. That's also literally stupid. It's also wrong. It's also in relation to delusion. It is wrong. It is an incorrect thing to say to oneself. It is an incorrect thing to say to one another. In the face of despair, we have a practice. We can turn to our practice. When I am faced with the very real experience of despair, I can meet my emotions with some kindness, and then I can ask myself, what's real here? What's true? Right? Buddha is not frightened by any feeling. Buddha knows that nothing will destroy him, that he is beyond any feeling and any state. Zazen mind. So remember where we started. Right? Buddhism is reality based. It is devoted to being in relationship with what is true. It is therefore optimistic. Right? As Buddhists, as humans, our profound obligation, our moral, our ethical, I think, obligation is to be hope. Because hope is the state of heart that most accurately reflects optimism and most accurately reflects truth. So to wrap up, let's go into 2021 together. We're going to anyway, whether we choose it or not. I'm just suggesting that we choose it. We make a choice. We choose what is. We're fond of doing that in this tradition, are we not? We recognize something as real. We therefore choose it. We put ourselves in alignment. Let's go into 2021 together. Let's do the things that help us. Let's do our zazen. Let's gather together. Let's make gratitude lists. Let's notice. Let's make a special effort to notice when things are okay. Notice when you're feeling okay. Something simple. Notice when things are working. Notice what's already there. Right? Hope is a state of heart that reflects what's happening now. Right? As well as aspiration for the future. So notice what's already working in your life right now. What you already do in your life right now that has meaning for you, that connects you to some part of yourself that feels deeper, more true. What you're doing right now that connects you with a sense of purpose or agency, right? Notice what you're doing right now already that connects you to your sense of your most loving, open, connected self, your sacred life. You're already doing it. Everybody is. Just notice it. Like in zazen, notice what's already happening. Because the whole earth is already your witness. Infinite brave and kind ancestors stand behind you right now on this very earth. And above you, as is above all of us, an infinite sea of stars. You are unshakable. So may this new year, may this moment, may this new breath find you connected to, protected by your deepest refuge, your truest self. Don't spend too much time worrying. You don't have to know how to do it. You don't have to know how to do this. Right? You've already been happening for 14 billion years. Okay? So hope is what you are. And you're right on time. I appreciate you listening this morning. I appreciate your attentiveness. I think, like a lot of us who are asked to offer thoughts like this, to give talks like this, we tend to give the talks that we most need to hear. So I appreciate the fact that you're here. And my sense is that I mostly gave that because I most needed to hear it. So I'm really glad that you're here with me. And thank you very much.